Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan. And today we're talking about batteries, electric vehicle batteries, and how a fellow by the name of Scott Case, a CEO and founder of Recurrent, has created a business out of defining the health of batteries in EVs. Just really happy to have Scott on the podcast today. Hey, Scott, greetings. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks, Ted.
And where are you as we speak?
Where am I? I live in Tacoma, Washington, so the TAC and SeaTac Airport. That's where my home is.
How long have you lived up there?
Well, in the Pacific Northwest, basically since high school. So, you know, I've been around a little bit. I was born in New Jersey. I don't know. Is this like a biography section of the podcast?
So, we'll just get
born
we'll
in
just...
New Jersey. I lived in Houston a little bit. But yeah, Pacific Northwestern for a while.
People love that part, Scott. I know. We'll get quickly to the business model. But
all right.
You went to Williams College. What did you study there?
Oh, I did not study used cars. I studied economics and political science, and then got a. Well, I guess I, you know, the economics part. I guess I did study used cars, supply and demand. You know.
But then went off to MIT Sloan School, and
I have all these fancy degrees, and you know, I now come back to my parents and I'm like, hey, guess what? I'm working in the used car industry, like with all these fancy degrees. It's pretty funny.
that is funny. Well, you prior to I've already introduced you as the founder and CEO of Recurrent Energy, so we're going to get there. But before that, you went and you worked in a company called Energy Savvy. And that was 10 years of your life or your professional career, right?
Yeah. Well, hang on. Before we talk about Energy Savvy, I want to make sure that we get our name right, because there are a wild number of Recurrent companies, and there is a Recurrent Energy, which is a solar developer in Canada, I think. And there's also Recurrent Technologies, which is a seller of used computer equipment to companies. And there's even a Recurrent Ventures, which is like a magazine publisher. So we're all in different categories, but I don't want to send traffic to the wrong Recurrent. So Recurrent EV or Recurrent Auto, or we just go by Recurrent. So
yeah.
Anyway, but Energy Savvy. I spent 10 years. We basically, it was a software company to help people make their houses more energy efficient. We worked with electric utilities to essentially help them with consumer engagement and data analytics. And, you know, honestly, as we were wrapping up that 10-year span, you know, electric utilities were figuring out what it was going to mean to have more and more EVs connected to their power plants and connected to their substations. And so I really kind of like came into auto through the electrical grid, I guess you could say that.
Yeah. Yeah. Did it just hit you that, I mean, you must have this penchant for data. You're a data guy somehow. And all this data analytics and data science, I mean, how did you position there? How did you get to the EV battery degradation and rating batteries?
Well, I should say that I was not, the way I did not do it was to be an EV owner myself or have gone through the used EV purchasing process. So I think that's like what a lot of people think is like, oh, this guy's been bleeding electrons since the first EV came out. But no, I lived in Seattle for 17 years prior to moving down to Tacoma during COVID. Yeah. And we didn't have a garage. We didn't have a driveway. We didn't even have off-street parking on our side of the street where we lived in Seattle. And so like, I didn't have anywhere to plug in. And it's not for lack of trying, but we were trying to figure out, could we run extension cords somehow like across the street in a fake speed bump? I mean, there was like all kinds of rigmarole, but basically I couldn't get an EV. And then when we moved down to Tacoma in, I guess it was 2021, I have a garage for the first time since high school. And so then finally I could get an EV, but I mean, for me, like how I kind of came about this without being a driver myself, it was actually working on another company idea, around reusing decommissioned EV batteries in, stationary grid storage. Like, I think that's going to, the, like, you know, utilities are going to have to, basically like absorb more and more and more renewable energy that needs to be kind of stored for some period of time. You know, typically it's going to be like, you know, a few hours, and then it gets discharged to basically make the electrical grid work long term. But and, you know, one way of doing that is, basically the way you need to do that is through the use of batteries. And so I was kind of thinking about, like, how could we take all these decommissioned batteries, which, you know, basically for an EV battery, like with the chemistry and everything like that, like they're good for a while longer in stationary storage than they are after they're done being a battery for vehicles. Basically, they're just the charge and discharge cycles are not as aggressive as they are for transportation. So, like, I went down that road for a while thinking about that as my next company, and ultimately concluded that there weren't enough decommissioned batteries for to really deploy in that way at grid scale. And so it's like, I can do that company, you know, next, basically after, you know, in the next 10 years. but in the meantime, you know, I kind of hit on this used car market when I is just in the process of diligencing that, that company idea, where I was like, you basically have like used EVs are essentially inventory in progress to becoming decommissioned batteries. So, it kind of made sense that was like, oh, I'll do this first, and then I'll do the stationary grid storage thing.
A good evolution. And when I heard you speak in Phoenix, I guess now even a couple of months ago, I was really struck by when you said, consumers have to look at the value of an EV differently. It's a used EV, in the old days when we had our ICE vehicle, our internal combustion engine vehicles, what's the read? What's the odometer read? That was the most important metric of sort of the life of that vehicle. And now, no, you were saying it's the battery is the most important aspect of the vehicle, and it's completely invisible to the consumer.
It's invisible, and it's disconnected from the odometer reading. That's I think what we're really seeing is there's all kinds of examples of how, you know, you've got a low mileage cars that whose batteries are really worn down, or, and on the flip side, high mileage cars whose batteries are in great shape. And there's a lot of reasons why both those things can be true. And so we really felt like there was a need to basically like make that visible and help people decide, you know, what they're going to get and take that into the shopping equation.
I'm going to ask you about degradation in a couple of questions, but how do you get a high mileage EV that's battery pack is really in very good shape?
One example is just about every Chevy Bolt ever made from 2017 to 2019 was subject to a battery recall and replaced sort of in some cases with higher capacity packs than what they originally had. So those are in great shape, even though some of them have 75,000, 100,000 miles or more on them.
Right. How would you describe the business model? How you're in the data science? I by the way, Scott, I signed up. I'm now one of your data providers, I guess, willingly provider. But how do you describe the business model and how you can sell? Who do you sell to, and how does that work?
Sure. Yeah. So first of all, if you are an EV owner listening to this podcast, and now you know, Ted, you went through the process yourself to sign up, it's a free offering. So basically, you give us permission to monitor your battery, and we connect to your vehicle's, your manufacturer's connected services account with your opt-in, right? And so we pick up a little bit of data, very shallow level of data, sort of two or three times a day, which is we ping the battery, and we're basically getting the odometer reading, the vehicle's state of charge, like how many electrons are in the tank right then, mm-hmm. and then the vehicle's range estimate, how far can it go until it's empty at that state of charge. And that's all stuff that you could see on the dashboard. And then over time, we can basically compare all of those readings, because, you know, as an EV driver, those fluctuate all over the place, right? You know, depending on the temperature and how fast you're driving and all those kinds of things. But over time, we can build a model on your car, and then we can compare that to hundreds and thousands of others that are comparable. And so understand essentially how good is your battery at sort of getting you range compared to what everybody else is. And that's a pretty good indicator, it turns out, of battery condition. Now, all of that. Oh, and then in exchange, by the way, for sharing your data with us, you get a monthly report that says how your battery is doing compared to when it was new and how it is compared to all the other ones that are comparable, same make, model, year, and battery pack configuration. And, you know, also, I think people like getting this because it also helps them care for their battery and their car in a better way. So, you know, everybody grew up, you grew up learning how to take care of a combustion engine car from your parents or grandparents. And you know, you couldn't do that with an EV. Like no one grew up learning how to do this from their parents. So I think a lot of people that are using that free offering are it's a good way to essentially like take care of your car better, right? So the way we monetize this, and we're really clear about this when we, you know, on our website and our business model, is we aggregate all that data up into a series of machine learning models that basically then can basically say when a car shows up, any car shows up at a used car lot, whether we've been connected to it or not in the past, we can basically sort of help the car dealer, or it could be the wholesale auction or whoever is the secondary buyer, get a reasonable gauge on like how good is this battery, how far is it, am I going to be able to drive with it, how is that going to change it for weather conditions, and how will it change over time. So answering all those shopper questions, and dealers and wholesale auctions pay us to basically provide that visibility to their customers, because that's something that they've seen is really valuable for the shopping process.
Yeah, interesting. Now, are all manufacturers eager to let you assess their battery's performance?
Well, I don't think all manufacturers know who we are, but you know, that's definitely been changing over time. I think what's cool about this from an automaker perspective and dealership perspective is that, generally speaking, the used EV shopper has like a model in their head, which is essentially informed by they've had an iPhone for, you know, or a series of iPhones over the past, you know, 15 years. And they know that that battery wears down. And that, what it means is they can't talk all day. And so they bring that mental model into the used EV shopping process when they get there. And so they assume that the car's battery wears down just like the iPhone does. And so with no other information, they're basically writing down the value of that car in an unfair way. And when we look at overall, I mean, if you sort of step back, like generally speaking, used EV batteries are holding up better than people expect them to based on their iPhones, you know, on their history with iPhones. So what that all means to the automakers is, with us as an independent third party providing transparency and helping people understand when they go to shop in the used market, that it's actually not as bad as they think most times. You know, there's variability, but most of the time it actually improves the resale value of the car, which is great for the automaker because it means their residual values are higher, and it means they can invest more and make the transition to electrification faster.
Yeah, that makes sense. I wanted to circle back. You said for an EV driver who's getting these monthly reports, they might learn how to take care of their batteries a little bit better. And how do you do that? Is it the same as with an internal combustion engine? You don't want to jam on the accelerator and you don't want to be jerking back and forth, or is it different?
Well, I suspect that most of the people that are listeners to your podcast are like, you know, longtime EV owners at this point, and they know exactly what they're doing and have done all of the research on themselves. But generally speaking, how you drive it doesn't really make much of a difference. How you charge it does. Are you keeping the charge level, generally speaking, most of the time between, you know, 20 or 30 and 80%? So like, are you mostly in that window in the middle, or are you going all the way from 0 to 100 a lot? That term is called depth of discharge. And what's the average depth of discharge? That's a factor. Another factor is that we've seen is, frequent use of DC fast charging. Now, there's a nuanced story here, because we actually did a study. We've done a number of studies, but we did one that got a lot of press a couple of months ago, where we were comparing Teslas that were frequently fast charged to ones that were rarely fast charged, and we didn't see a lot of difference in their dashboard range displays. But there's a lot more nuance, you know, underneath the data of that. And what I would say to anyone is like if you have the choice to be yeah. on level two charging at home, and you can do most of your charging there. That is going to be better for you in the long run, with the occasional fast charging when you're out on road trips, totally fine. If all you're doing is feeding your car a diet of DC fast charging, like I think that it is going to wear the car, the battery down a little faster on the margins. And that is going to vary from car to car.
Yeah.
From manufacturer to manufacturer, based on different battery chemistry and electrical engineering choices they've made.
But interesting. I mean, I know a lot of Tesla owners that are just using that supercharging network, and they're always at a DC fast charge as opposed to the level two.
Yeah, that does exist. And, you know, however, I will say that, like, you know, the across the board, it's something like 80% of charging events happen at home. So, and those are all level two charges, right? So you do have folks that that don't have a setup like me in Seattle, right? I didn't have a way to fast charge or to have home charging, right? Because I didn't have the garage or driveway or off-street right. parking. So right. I didn't have an option at that point. So there are some that's kind of unavoidable, but like, you know, because yeah, you do, there are, except for situations where someone, even if you don't have a place to charge at home, like you might have a level two charging at your place of work that you can charge during the day. And I actually think that's a great option. But again, not everybody has that exactly. So, you know, I think that people should think about how they charge their car is like, you know, it's got to fit into your lifestyle and your commute patterns and everything like that. Like you can't sort of set aside your entire life and sort of where you need to go and when you need to go there in order to just sort of like optimize the health of your EV battery. That doesn't make any sense.
That's right. Who's serving who at this?
Yeah,
point.
Exactly.
Let's talk battery degradation. And I think I told you that my gal has a Tesla Model Y and she's had it for a little over a year and she's noticed, because she's an electrical engineer, so she notices a lot of things, but she's noticed much more degradation than she thought that she would. And she's really actually kind of disappointed by it, because she's thinking that she was sort of sold the long range bill of goods. And now the degradation, I don't really know what the numbers are, down maybe 2 or 3%, but is that normal? And is that, what's your reaction to that, Scott?
Well, Teslas are a little special. There's a couple of things going on here. First is the dashboard rated range on Teslas is sort of famously not the same as the actual range that they can go. And there have been lots of sort of press about that. And you can even see it on the Tesla dashboard in different screens. Like their rated range is different from if you use the trip planner and do navigation, like they will give you different numbers. So that's like one thing, is you can't just look at the dashboard and understand battery degradation. The second thing is like range is not the same as battery health, right? State of health of the battery. So they are related, but there's a lot of things that manufacturers can do to basically kind of conflate the two and obscure underlying battery degradation and make it so that it doesn't show up in the user experience. Like, for instance, you know, all manufacturers with different degrees of, with different approaches can use like essentially hold back a buffer of battery capacity that is not opened up to the user initially, and then can be opened up over time as the overall battery degrades. So like there's just a lot of different strategies out there, and it's all different from manufacturer to manufacturer. But that said, like generally speaking, yeah, in Teslas as in other EVs, especially during the first couple of years, there is kind of a break-in period where you lose like a little bit of range, you know, over the first couple of years, kind of an initial period. And then there's typically a long flat pot plateau where, you know, it stays about the same. And then, you know, when a battery is really sort of like failing, there's a rapid loss of capacity towards the end, and that's known as like the heel period. And you know, reality is like not very many cars have gotten to that point, outside of just like manufacturing issues and that sort of thing. But you know, most of the cars that are, you know, that have ever been produced are still on the road. So, you know, our EVs are only the oldest ones are only about 11 years old. So, you know, right. I think that we're well, still,
when,
we're still
when
waiting
it gets to that heel. What capacity is that battery? 60% or 65? I'm talking, this is your next career, Scott, we're talking about.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's true. That's a great point. So, there is, you know, generally speaking, like the battery warranty levels that manufacturers sort of put in there, that's a pretty good indicator of when you're sort of approaching the end of the useful life for transportation purposes. And that tends to be, if you look at the fine print, it tends to be around 65, 70% of original capacity. I should phrase it very carefully, state of health is the term they use for that. But what happens, like the other thing to think about is, like, you know, you might think like, well, if I have a you know, a car with a 300 mile range initially, 70% of that doesn't sound too bad. It's like, it's fine. But the problem that you have is that at the same time that you're losing capacity, the battery is also building up more charging and discharging resistance. And so what that means is, like, your charging speed is decreasing. So it's like, that's a little bit of a pain, but the bigger problem is your discharging speed is also decreasing. And what that means is, like, you know, when you're going to get on the freeway and you floor it to get up to speed, there's not as much get up as there used to be. And that's, I think, what the bigger issue of where the battery is not really able to be used for transportation purposes anymore. But then, hey, that's a great battery for the grid, because charging and discharging happens much more slowly than, you know, essentially merging onto a freeway on ramp.
And that's one of the great pleasures of being an EV driver, is being able to merge onto the freeway on ramps and just being able to dust everybody else when you want to. It just takes off. These EVs is just a play. But Scott, going back, you said so many things that interest me, because I'm realizing that EVs are much more like a piece of software than they are like an old motor. But did you say that manufacturers are or they have the capacity to hold back some of the battery capacity in the early years, so that as the battery degrades, they can open up sort of more, I guess it would be more cells in the battery pack? Are they actually doing that, or is that just a possibility?
No, virtually every manufacturer, when you look at the physical capacity of the battery, is different from the virtual capacity of the battery. So typically, like, and usually that offset is, like, you know, can be 10%. That's almost always the case. And you can sort of look up these facts of, you know, like, you know, my ID4, I think, has an 82 kilowatt hour battery, I think, and like the virtual battery that's sort of allowed to be used for, you know, by the user is smaller than that, maybe 77 or something like that. Now, so everybody has that, right?
Yeah.
Not all of them take the approach of gradually opening that buffer up. That's where you get some manufacturer differences. Some of them just sort of maintain that so that they ensure that you're never actually, even if you are going from 0 to 100 of the virtual battery, you're not actually going from 0 to 100 of the physical battery, because they know that would be very, very destructive. And so they're essentially like keeping those guardrails on the user behavior. But, you know, and there are other situations, like Tesla has definitely done this, where they have models of vehicle where like there you could buy like the Model S's used to have like 60 and 80, they had like numbers associated with them, which corresponded with the kilowatt hour capacity. And there were several periods where they shipped the Model S the 60D or whatever with the exact same physical battery as the 75D, and then after the fact, you could pay to unlock the rest of it, basically. So you could pay to upgrade it from a 60D to a 75D after the fact.
Yeah. Upgrade your software.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think I heard that some of the Teslas have all the same speakers in them for the stereo system.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then you can pay to upgrade your similarly. Just a couple more questions, and we're going to let you go. But on battery degradation, what's the worst thing for EV batteries? Is it cold? Is it extreme heat? Is it, what is it?
Oh, temperature wise?
Well, I don't know. Is that the number one degradation a factor for batteries?
No, it's not. You know, I think that we talked through the depth of discharge, sort of charging speed, basically, are sort of our factors there. Temperature is an interesting one, although not all that actionable, you know, to be frank. But let me break the temperature thing down two ways. On a day-to-day basis, if you are driving in extreme cold, like, you will lose range on your trips. That's for basically just because it's actually mostly the result of cabin heating is just like takes is pretty energy intensive and sure. Sort of interestingly like done in different ways compared to combustion engine cars, but you're not hurting your battery over time by driving in the cold. It's fine. It's a little like, I don't know if you grew up storing your Duracell batteries in the freezer before you use them. Does that ring any bells? Like, we did that in my family. But anyway, So like, keep having your EV in a very cold environment is a little like storing your Duracell batteries in the freezer. The flip side, though, is in extreme heat situations, like, you don't lose very much range on a day-to-day basis, but long term, you do actually, all else being equal, you have a little more long term battery degradation as a result of exposure to extreme heat than you do in extreme cold.
And it just seems that with all these new battery chemistries coming onto the market, you know, in the next 5 years, you know, you sort of feel like you're getting a good understanding of what the major degradation factors are, and then maybe they change. But I wanted to, just before I let you go, I wanted to just ask you a little bit about EV efficiency. And previously we discussed this whole notion that all EVs are not equally efficient. And we talked about kilowatt hours or how many miles per kilowatt hour. And
yeah, you're a hypermiler, right? If I recall this correctly.
I think I'm at about 5.1 miles per kilowatt. But you said, well, hey, you live in Southern California. That should be the case. And maybe it is,
how fast you drive. Are you driving on the freeway at 70 miles an hour, or are you driving on surface streets at 30 miles an hour? There's going to be huge differences in efficiency there as well.
Right. But comment if you would just on the heavy pickup trucks, and are they getting, you know, they probably weigh twice as much as my EV or your EV. Are they getting half the mileage?
Yeah. Remind me what you drive again.
Well, I've got a Bolt, and then we've also got a Tesla. So we have
And you get 5.1 miles to the kilowatt hour in your Bolt.
In the Bolt, I think the Tesla. Yeah. I don't know what the Tesla is getting, but I'm assuming around 4.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean the just to put that in perspective, for, you know, compare that to the F-150 Lightning. You know, average miles per kilowatt hour of the F-150 Lightning is less than 2. So like far less efficient than your Bolt. But you know, part of this is weight. You know, like, I'm just doing some very quick Googling. So the F-150 weighs, depending on the battery pack configuration, the curb weight of the car is 6,000 to 7,000 pounds. Now, I'm just out of curiosity, I'm going to find out how much your Bolt weighs. So your Bolt weighs half of that. So you know, it's practically like, actually, I think your Bolt may weigh less than the battery pack alone of the Hummer EV. So carrying that amount of just mass around the, you know, and driving it from place to place, it's just that takes a lot of energy to just carry around the mass of the battery, plus all the fuselage and the steel and everything like that of those really large cars. So, you know, you've got, you can kind of get into this, like, you know, doom loop situation with, you know, the more, like, the heavier the car is, the bigger the battery has to be to get it a reasonable number of miles. And the bigger the battery is, the heavier it is. And so it just keeps on getting worse and worse. And so, you know, I think it's going to be a real struggle to have those really big, heavy trucks kind of get what I think most people want from a range perspective without real changes in the battery chemistry.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it just stands to reason. I just make a pitch for it. You know, yeah, if you really want to do your bit to protect the climate, you know, we certainly want to adopt EVs and electric mobility as fast as possible, but recognize that not all EVs are equally efficient, and that if you can get away with a smaller vehicle, it certainly makes a lot of sense. Last question: where do you take Recurrent EV or Recurrent Auto from here? You're in the single family or single passenger vehicle market right now. Do you get into trucks and buses and other forms of e-mobility? Or
yeah, I don't think so. I think that there's maybe some crossover around like e-transit and Rivian delivery vans, like that kind of like the light duty passenger vehicles, but sort of, you know, medium duty. There's maybe some crossover there, but you know, I don't think there's a lot of there just aren't enough trucks and buses, you know, for us to really kind of like get involved in at that heavy duty end. That's the focus for me. And by the way, like just to circle back around, I wanted to comment on your, if you want to do your bit thing, I will say that like the New York Times did a great visualization of this, of like, you know, basically the efficiency on a carbon emissions perspective of every combustion engine vehicle and then every EV. And it is pretty much the case that every EV is more energy efficient and has lower emissions than every combustion engine vehicle. But there are like there's overlap right at the edges. So like a very small efficient gas car is about the same carbon emissions as like the F-150 Lightning and the Hummer EV. So like the very worst you could do from an EV perspective is about the same as the very best you could do for a gas car. But so anyway, but I suspect that like there's not a lot of people that are like going from, you know, the Camry to the Hummer EV is my guess. I think mostly you get your category. Here's the way you do your bit is drive less, you know, no matter what your car is, drive less and take more public transportation, you know. And I guess like company values perspective for us, like, you know, we acknowledge that like we want fewer single passenger vehicles on the road overall, you know, and but we acknowledge that people still are going to drive, you know, and they're still going to need you know, light duty passenger vehicles. And so we would just prefer that the ones out there be more efficient, be electric faster than we were maybe on a route to anyway.
Yeah, great.
So stuff. Less driving, but what remains, let's make it electric.
Absolutely. Hey, listen, thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for your time today. It was great talking to you.
Thanks.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.